transcorridor alternative analysis and rail network integration study, the business plan for electric passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch rail line. Ginger, I don't want to hack your name here, Dykar, will be presenting with the staff report.
Thank you, Chair. I'll wait for the PowerPoint to come up before I get started.
And just a reminder to the public and the commission, we're going to allow 1 minute for public comment on this item and 2 minutes for the commissioner's comment, and then we'll go into the discussion to allow more conversation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Yes.
I'd like to move that we overrule your decision, not on the 1 minute for the public, but that the commissioners on this important item need as much time with, you know, the, I hope everybody would be reasonable, but not be limited to 2 minutes. That's my motion to overrule you. I'd argue that we shouldn't debate it. We should just vote it up or down, but that, I'd like to overrule you on this question. And people understand the choice we're making, I think.
I'll second that.
Okay.
It's just on the time for the commissioners, not.
What time would you recommend?
I'd leave it open-ended and tell commissioners to try and be brief, but it's a critically important decision. We should not be limited in our ability to debate the issue.
Okay, I just didn't want commissioners to ramble on for half an hour.
No, I understand your point, and I think people should be guided by your sense about that. And you can remind people they're taking too long, et cetera, but I don't think that they should be limited strictly to 2 minutes. That's my motion.
I have a motion on the table and a second.
And again, I'd rather than debate it hugely. I mean, again, it's not unreasonable what you're proposing, but I just think it'd be better for us, our process. We should move quickly to a vote on the issue.
I'm allowing it. Again, we have a motion on the table and a second. You allow the commissioners to speak freely, but within a time constraint at the same time, and allowing the chair to interrupt. Is that correct?
That's it.
Okay. Can I have a roll call?
Chair Gonzalez, I'm sorry to interrupt. Before we move on to this vote, I just want to make it a note that I was not called to vote on the last vote. And I just want to make sure that it's in the record that I'm voting aye on the recommendation to move to ask staff to come back with information about individual appointments. I apologize for the interruption, but I wasn't called to vote on that one. And so I want to make sure that it's in the record that I am voting aye on that.
My apologies, Commissioner Peterson.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up for our attention, Commissioner. It's been noted. So we're back to a motion to not restrict the time limits on the commissioners to speak on this item on the agenda, but to allow the chair to interrupt if they're taking too long.
And I'll call the question for a roll call vote.
Roll call, please.
Commissioner Bertrand?
I agree.
Commissioner Brown?
Aye.
Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Montesino?
Aye.
Commissioner Caput?
Aye.
Commissioner Schifrin?
Aye.
Commissioner Mulhern?
Aye.
Commissioner Koenig?
Aye.
Commissioner McPherson?
Aye.
Commissioner Peterson?
Aye.
Commissioner Gonzalez?
Aye.
Commissioner Rockin.
Aye.
Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and we'll proceed with a staff report.
Good morning, Chair, Commissioners, and members of the public. I'm Ginger Dykar, Senior Transportation Planner on RTC staff. The item before you today is the business plan for electric passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch Rail Line, which is the final component of the Transit Corridor Alternatives Analysis and Rail Network Integration Study. The staff recommendation is to review and provide input on the business plan, adopt a resolution accepting the business plan as a guide for implementing electric passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch Rail Line, and to direct staff to seek federal and or state funding to complete the preliminary engineering and environmental documentation for electric passenger rail. There are numerous members of the project team here today to present information as well as answer questions. I'll provide a brief overview of the project, then hand off to Steve Decker, who's the project manager from HDR, who will be presenting the business plan, and Pam Yonkin, also from HDR, who will discuss the cash flow analysis. Next slide, please. At the February 4th RTC meeting, the RTC accepted the Transit Corridor Alternatives Analysis and Rail Network Integration Study, which selects electric passenger rail as the locally preferred alternative for the Santa Cruz Branch rail line. The alternatives analysis evaluated various transit alternatives to identify a locally preferred alternative that provides the greatest benefit to Santa Cruz County residents, businesses, and visitors in terms of the triple bottom line goals of improving economy, equity, and the environment. A draft business plan is presented today to serve as a guiding document for funding and implementation of electric passenger rail. The plan includes the characteristics of electric passenger rail, information on governance options for how passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch rail line could be administered, provides the detail of the cost estimates for both capital costs and operations and maintenance that were brought together for the main report. It discusses the implementation steps for the project and provides potential revenue sources, federal, state, and local. It also presents a cash flow model for funding the project and includes a risk identification section. I do want to make sure the commission realizes that both the governance discussion and the steps for implementation of the locally preferred alternative are needed to meet the requirements of the Caltrans grant for the rail network integration study. With that, I'll hand off now to Steve Decker of HDR to discuss the details of the business plan.
Thank you, Ginger. Everybody hear me?
Yes.
Great. The business plan, the last component of the alternatives analysis and rail network integration study, we, of course, you know, tacked on to the various alternatives analysis phases. Previous slide. And this just provides the characteristics of the electric passenger rail that has been suggested to move forward on the branch line right of way. You've seen this before, electric passenger rail. You know, as we go through the next component of the work, the preliminary design and environmental analysis, the technology will be clarified in that component. We're looking at 30 to 60 miles per hour on the line, depending on the configuration and the technology, 11 to 15 stations with level platform boarding. That provides easy access to passengers. This will be electric, so we're looking at current technology and, of course, emerging technology, including hydrogen fuel cell, and we show a few examples later, and battery as well, and other future technology as well. So we'll have to work with Federal Railroad Administration, Federal Transit Administration for a variety of issues, as well as with Caltrans on vehicle types. We need to comply. Service frequencies are anticipated to be 30 to 60 minutes, depending on the time of day. And the weekday service will be from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. So that's just a general summary of the service. Next slide. In terms of the vehicle types, we identified these in the business plan. These are all electric or hydrogen cell. As you see, there's no third rail, which is often used to power electric trains. There's no catenary or above. Well, you see one on the side here, but that's at a station. I'll try to walk through these. On the top left is a hydrogen cell train. Looks like a light rail vehicle mainly. These are in operation in Germany and Austria. The middle top, called Arrow, is being considered. It's a hydrogen cell train being considered in Redlands for commuter rail, and that's down in San Bernardino County. The top left, or the top right, sorry, is a battery electric train in Japan, operating in Japan. Then moving over to the bottom left, we have a battery electric train looking like a light rail vehicle that operates in China. The middle bottom is a battery electric system, a Siemens train operating in Austria. And then on the bottom right, that's the TIG hydrogen fuel cell, I believe, operating in Qatar. So those are some examples, and obviously these are going to emerge as we get through the next component of the analysis. Next slide, please. In terms of the implementation process, we've gone through the alternatives analysis, the rail network integration study analysis. These components follow the project delivery, project implementation cycle. And these components, there are six components that follow, with the first component being preliminary engineering and environmental documentation. The cost estimates were based on our value engineering and detailed cost estimates developed in the alternatives analysis study. And these are, you know, plus or minus, obviously, but these are our estimates. So the preliminary engineering environmental documentation can start at any moment. You know, it's based on, of course, availability of funding, et cetera. But this provides the opportunity to get into detail in the right of way, understanding infrastructure, the rail line, structures, all those things, really refining where the stations are, how it works with the entire system, those kinds of things. Once that's completed, that's about 30% design preliminary engineering. Component two, this information feeds into component two to get the final design and the permitting process, which would be 100% design. And then that leads into right-of-way acquisition needs. And right now we haven't identified any there. Those acquisition needs would be determined when we get into final design and permitting. That would then lead to construction, including construction management of the service. And then once we get pretty far along there, we'll get into vehicle procurement and component five, and then testing and commissioning would be a big component of number six in terms of the annual operations maintenance. So the testing and commissioning would actually occur of the service probably in the first year than compared to the other years of the O&M. Operations and maintenance. Next slide, please. So as I discussed in component one, we did, and in the business plan, we did provide some detail in terms of different steps associated with component one, preliminary engineering, this 30% engineering and the full environmental documentation. The first step is an initial conceptual design and refinement of the operating plan from the alternatives analysis, and this will get us to about 10%. This is where we really evaluate structures, rail curvatures, potential train speeds, how this would work with the stations. That would be, those are critical, and we haven't gotten through that process yet. That's part of the engineering design process. From that, we'll go to step 1.2 to identify any critical issues related to design. You know, maybe the railroad needs some significant, you know, improvements, and that's where those will be determined based on those issues. And Ginger also mentioned the governance strategy. This is where we'll work with RTC, Caltrans, and others to define that strategy and how to run and operate the system in step 1.2. Then that will lead into the final conceptual design, which is about 20% design and a refined operating plan. And all these include refined estimates of ridership and costs and all those kinds of things. And then we'll flow into the environmental analysis and documentation, and we'll get to a 30% design, preliminary design. And the culmination here will feed into the next component, number two. And we will also look at, you know, identify vehicle types, technologies in this step as well. Next slide, please. So in terms of governance options, as Ginger mentioned, you know, what is the structure and strategy to run and operate the system? And there are different models, as you can see here. We won't get into a lot of detail here, but the governance options really are, you know, what entity will be running and operating the system, be responsible for policy, coordination of services, funding and procurement of vehicles, of other rail infrastructure needs, you know, operating and maintaining the system, as well as marketing the service, providing a variety of other other things associated with running this service. In terms of common operational or strategies here in California, joint powers authorities, there are several here that are separate entities that are created to specifically run passenger rail and other types of services. There are some common ones here in California, including the Losan corridor up and down the coast, Caltrain or Samtrans. There's a joint powers authority to run Caltrain, Capital Corridor. Those are some examples. Joint ventures are also entities that are created from maybe two cities or multiple agencies to run and operate a system, slightly different than joint powers authorities. There are no real common examples here in California. There's some in Texas and Virginia and a few other places that we can use as a guide. In terms of special purpose, these are regional transit authorities or districts. There are examples here and elsewhere. They are common in California. The Smart Corridor, for example, up in Marin is an example of a special purpose RTA or RTD. There are also examples of counties or municipalities running the transit service. Our work in San Bernardino with the Redlands is an example of the San Bernardino, I believe, Association of Governments running that service. That is not common in California, but it does happen in California and elsewhere. And then the state DOT or transit agency can run and operate typically more rural, smaller systems. And there really are no examples of that in California, but there are elsewhere. And these are the kinds of governance strategies we'll be exploring when we get to that stage or that component.
Can I ask a question? If the transit district, existing Metro Transit District were appointed, or however they decided to run this thing, which of these is that described as? It's not really a joint powers authority. It's a separate standalone agency.
That would probably be more the county or municipal transit agency, that model. Yeah.
Commissioner,
in terms of, go ahead.
Presentation to end so we can ask questions. Thank you.
Well, the talking about risks here, these risks are not unusual for a project like this. They're common with just about every type of project that, you know, we come across or we want to implement, or, you know, agencies want to implement in California and elsewhere. Certainly funding is a risk. In this case, compatibility with future freight, recreational services and trails is going to be a big issue and need to really address that. Stakeholder and public support, of course, is a risk that needs to be mitigated and addressed, and that's sort of the intent of all these risks, to identify strategies to mitigate and address the risks. Certainly, you know, the organizational development, how this works with RTC, Metro, and a joint powers authority or other governance strategy, delivering the project. So there are a lot of potential risks here, but these are not uncommon on a project like this throughout California and elsewhere. With that said, I'll turn this back over. I'll turn this over to Pam to talk about cash flow.
Thanks, Steve. So this first slide that we're looking at, you'll see, presents a cash flow model. It's for 25 years, and we have it starting in fiscal year 2020, but it could really be any start year, and the flow would generally be similar. If you're having trouble seeing this on the screen, by the way, take a look at pages 7-5 of the draft business plan, and there should be a clearer copy for you. Just to kind of orient you, the fiscal years are across the top, and then revenues and expenses are listed along the side. I mentioned the first year of analysis is FY 2020, but this is just a guiding document, so this is one scenario for how this could come to fruition. 4 years are estimated to complete preliminary design and environmental review, and then 3 years are estimated for design, permitting, and right-of-way, with 6 years of construction and procurement of vehicles. And then the remaining 11 years is for O&M. If you look along the first column, you'll see there's a variety of potential funding sources that would support the capital component of this project. There's federal, there's the Capital Investment Grant 5309, which is an FTA program. There's also some discretionary grant options such as BUILD, and with the new administration's focus on rail, which I know Guy mentioned earlier, this project is pretty consistent with what we'd expect them to be looking for and interested in funding. If you go down under the state sources, you'll see there's a variety of them. You'll note that we are assuming SB1 state rail assistance funding that would cover 17.1 million. That's component one of the project. So that's the preliminary engineering and environmental. Where RTC is already working with the Caltrans Division of Rail and Mass Transportation on the possibility of fully funding the project's preliminary engineering and environmental documentation with state funding sources. And those could include the state rail assistance program or some Caltrans planning funding. And the funds don't require matching funds, which is a good element of that funding source. Caltrans is very supportive of the program and the project, and they understand the many benefits that could bring to Santa Cruz. So, that's a reasonably valid assumption to make. It's got larger regional implications too for the Central Coast and to the state. Just a little bit on the capital investment grant, which is the largest element of the cash flow for the federal funding piece. You only have to apply once to enter the capital investment grant program, and once an agency has developed initial planning and engineering to document the project's definition and develop a preliminary capital cost estimate, you send a letter to FTA and you enter the project development phase. Once FTA approves that, the project is in the pipeline and you start moving forward the activities that you need to complete during each component. RTC has to document to FTA that the funds needed to complete the project development activities, so those early on activities are committed. And once FTA approves the request to enter project development, all project related costs incurred are eligible for reimbursement. So it's a really nice program for a project of this kind. You wanted to switch, I can talk a little bit about O&M. So this is similarly structured with the years across the top and then the sources of funds down the left-hand side. The amount of revenue from farebox recovery, which you'll notice is a line item about two-thirds of the way down. We assumed $4.50 per boarding, but this decision would be determined during future components of the project. The unidentified amounts could come from local sources, possibly a sales tax or other local source of funds, but I do want to point out that there are federal operations and maintenance funding sources available too to help support this project. I want to switch to the last slide. So this is just a graphic of what we've just presented in a tabular form. Funding required is along the y-axis. Fiscal years are across the horizontal axis. And what the graph is attempting to show is the anticipated funding for different components of the project. So green is the funding that we've identified. So that would be those sources that we've identified in the previous tables. And then blue is the unidentified funding. And it's worth noting that the bulk of the funding that will be required is needed during construction and vehicle procurement. And right now we're assuming that the vehicles will be procured in fiscal year 31-32, which explains the jump in the visual. That could vary as we get a little bit more information on timing, but that's what we're assuming and understand to be reasonable right now. And then the last element of it is operations and maintenance, and that is obviously available or needed once the project is operational. And with that, I think I will pass it back to Ginger.
Thank you, Pam. I just want to wrap up the presentation by outlining the benefits of completing environmental review. Along with environmental review, 30% of the engineering design will be completed, which will help to answer community questions about the project in more detail than has been we've been able to do to date, such as station and siting locations, any right-of-way needs, service headways and span, vehicle types, integration with local metro services, as well as any impacts that are identified through environmental analysis. A 30% preliminary design would also provide a more accurate cost estimate for the project. And another important reason for moving forward with preliminary engineering and environmental review is that there are now currently four different future potential uses of the Santa Cruz Branch Rail Line right-of-way. We have freight rail, recreational rail, passenger rail transit, and the trail. And coordination of these four uses now will help to avoid the risk of increased cost and delay both the trail projects and the rail transit project in the future. Many funding programs require environmental review to be completed prior to funding the project. So completing environmental review will allow RTC to be ready when funds become available from federal or state sources. And it's highly likely that additional funding sources for transit will become available at the federal and state level in the coming years to combat climate change. The completion of environmental review in a timely manner would allow Santa Cruz County to compete for available funds for the next component of the project. A dedicated transit facility is the type of project that will attract these state and federal funds. Another reason is that the Measure D rail corridor funds are currently being used to preserve the rail corridor infrastructure with many competing needs. The sooner passenger rail moves into the construction component of the project, the sooner the funds from outside funding programs can be used to replace and rehabilitate the infrastructure for passenger rail, allowing more of the Measure D funds to go towards preservation of the infrastructure after service has begun. In taking this next step towards designing and analyzing the impacts of electric passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch rail line, the RTC will be working towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation and providing an equitable option for travel for Santa Cruz County residents, students, and visitors. The importance of moving passenger rail project on the branch line cannot be overemphasized. There is no other corridor in Santa Cruz County at present that readily provides this opportunity to significantly improve transit travel times. Rail transit will provide a fast, safe, and accessible option for travel for both residents and visitors and will improve quality of life here in Santa Cruz County. With Caltrans, CalSTA, and California Transportation Commission wanting to see this project implemented, and with the Biden administration's $2 trillion plan to fund infrastructure, now is a good time to seek funds for environmental review. With that, it finalizes the presentation today on the business plan. There are numerous members of the project team at the meeting today to answer questions. On the HDR team, besides Steve Decker and Pam Yonkins, who presented today, we have Buzz Berger from HDR as well. From Metro, we have John Ergo. And from RTC staff, Executive Director Guy Preston, Deputy Director Luis Mendez, Rachel Morricone, and Brianna Goodman. Shannon Simons is also in attendance from Caltrans Division of Rail and Mass Transportation, and but she does have to leave at 11:30 this morning. So with that, I'm happy to take comments and answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ginger, for that presentation. Thank you for all your work, and thank you all put this plan together. I'm going to bring it back to the commission for questions only. Only questions, please. Is there any commissioner that has any questions? I see Jack Beltran. Jack, has your hand raised?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. Just have a few questions. If the rail line, proposed rail line, is going to be a commuter line, how can you support 30 to 60 minute headways when my version of commuter lines usually have like 5 to 10 minute headways, especially when you have large population densities? It requires short headways to meet the commuter requirements. Would you comment on that, please?
I'd be happy to. RTC has the ability to determine the headways that are most appropriate for our community. I don't know of any set requirements for headways in order to get certain types of funding. I don't know if there's Steve from HDR or Shannon Simons has other information based on that, but you know, I do see this as something that we can create the system that works best for our community.
Thank you, Ginger. The main reason why I brought that comment up is because headway means you're going to have people waiting at a station, you know, 30 to 60 minutes before the train arrives. That does not present a very good way to provide commuter options that really want to, if they left from Watsonville to Santa Cruz, the train will still be waiting. They'll still be waiting for a train before it gets there. So thank you for your answer. The other question I have is, how did the group determine, or what was the process and what data did they use to figure out how many people would be on the train to support the fare that is anticipated? What data was actually used? And is this public available data? Thank you.
Let's see. So the fair assumptions right now are just based on an assumption. Obviously, the fares would have to be determined in the future once the governing body is brought on board. That assumption was just used for determining the potential fare revenue that would be available from ridership. But this is, another piece of the puzzle that still needs to be solved to determine how best to provide an equitable option for our community, and that would be decided in a future phase.
Thank you, Ginger, for your answer. But my question was mostly focused on how many people would be riding the trains. You know, in previous studies, there's been numbers, and we're sort of basing our fare take based on those numbers. Yes, you're right. We're going to adjust it as accordingly. But there must have been some studies to try to figure out. Caltrans does give daily data on how many people go from where to where. And is this some data that you've used? I'm trying to get a clear idea of how the ridership has been established. Thank you.
We have a lot of good analysis that Bear and Pierce did on the ridership numbers
Thank
for
you.
The study, but I'm happy to hand it over to Steve from HDR and he can provide some details there.
Thank right. Thank you, Ginger. RTC has a travel demand forecasting model that is fairly sophisticated, that is based on real data, real travel demand for all modes. And that data set is used for a lot of different types of studies, including the previous Unified Corridor study, including this study. This study was supplemented with significant cell phone data called streetlight data that really identifies a significant level of origin and destination for riders, potential riders. So that data was built into the ridership model. So the ridership is based on what people actually do, and it's validated to that level. And then we're forecasting out based on what's happening in the county with land use and socioeconomic growth, population and employment, those kinds of things. So that tool was used to support the ridership analysis in this study.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. Is this a peer-reviewed model, just like the AMBAG model is? AMBAG model is based, they use it for state projections. It's definitely accepted by Sacramento. Is this a standalone or is this peer-reviewed? Thank you.
Go ahead, Ginger.
The Santa Cruz County model, has not gone through the federal peer review process that I think you're referring to. The AMBAG model has
That's what I want to know.
Okay.
I appreciate
it. But I will say it was based on the AMBAG model that was peer reviewed. Anyway.
I know initially AMBAG had some input. I have another comment or question, if I may, Chair.
Your last question, and then I have one more question.
Huh? Thank you. Okay. I believe the right-of-way issue is not going to be a zero-cost issue. So what are you basing that on? I think there's a lot of right-of-way issues. I think it was referred to earlier in one of the public comments.
So the right-of-way, obviously we want to try to, any station locations or siding locations, we're really trying to work within our right-of-way that we have right now. That would be the easiest and most straightforward. We have discussed that there may, at some of those stations, we may need to acquire right-of-way. It's really unknown at this point, and that's what we're working towards, is to try to stay within our right-of-way as much as possible.
Thank you, Ginger. I think most of the answers to the questions have basically said there's a lot of unknowns, and I really appreciate your forthrightness.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Peterson, and then Commissioner Randy Johnson.
Thank you. Commissioner Bertrand already asked a question I had about the right-of-way acquisitions and why it's determined to be zero cost at this point, so I'll skip that question. I also had a question on in the section regarding regulatory compliance, the regulatory compliance analysis. It mentions 10 different federal, state, and local agencies, but one of them that I don't see mentioned in the report is the Coastal Commission. And so I'm wondering if there's been any consideration of the work that would have to be done with the Coastal Commission for addressing issues like coastal access points that may be inaccessible once retaining walls and other kinds of barriers are put up. Has there been any work into that?
So that's obviously we could add the Coastal Commission to that list there. It was just a list of possible agencies to be considered. The Coastal Commission did provide a letter of support. I believe it was in the February meeting for the rail, electric passenger rail on the Santa Cruz Branch rail line. You know, they see this as providing access to the coast, which is one of their missions. But you know, again, a lot of these details would need to be figured out in order to make sure that the Coastal Commission mission is being moved forward by providing this access and not limiting the access.
Thank you.
Is that all the questions you have, Commissioner?
That's all for me. Yes, thank you.
Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. So post COVID-19, there's been a new paradigm in terms of people who travel versus what we're doing right now. Did you take into consideration that new paradigm when you thought about the amount of number of people, I should say, and demand for, you know, any form of transportation, whether it be cars, bus, or rail, or bicycling for that matter?
The ridership numbers that were based, that were determined for the transit corridor alternatives analysis were based primarily on the pre-COVID numbers. You know, things were changing rapidly with COVID. There was not a lot of information as far as what the ridership would be post-COVID world. So the ridership is based on a pre-COVID world. It's such an unknown what's going to happen in the future, but I think in the last few months we're seeing that people are getting back into their various different activities that they've been stopped from doing in the last year.
Are you seeing that? You may be seeing that, but is that justified by the facts and data? I mean, we're all here, and there's a bunch of us I see on my screen who are not traveling today, including probably Caltrans representative, I think, who is from San Luis Obispo, right? So is it fair to say that demand probably isn't going to go up, but most likely will go down? Is that a fair statement?
I think it's fair to say that the future is unknown and that we're planning for a horizon of 10 to 15 years out. But it's hard to say what's going to happen.
Hard to say what's going to happen. Thank you for that.
If I could add to that, Mr. Johnson, most agencies, including the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, the Bay Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, they have decided to go pre-COVID and then to define post-COVID in terms of, you know, pre-COVID existing conditions analysis for their studies, and then, you know, compiling and obtaining as much information and future data and this research on what COVID did across all modes and is impacting all modes, including travel demand, to build that into the process. So the research has, some research has shown we're getting close to same levels of, say, traffic movements, but it has not been a lot of data about, you know, use of facilities, use of transit, or where people are coming from or going to, those kinds of research things that would be very helpful, but the information just has not, and research has not been conducted yet. So we will, in this process, we will revise and refine the ridership estimates, working with, you know, federal agencies to make sure that it lines up with COVID and other, you know, post-COVID situations.
So are you saying that with schools, majority of schools still being out, with people zooming like crazy, that we're now approaching pre-COVID levels of transportation? I find that hard to believe, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, I have seen that, some research or some evidence of that. I have not, you know, I really don't know what the research really says, though, but I've seen that kind of tally recently.
Thank you. Is there any other commissioner that would like to ask a question? Staff?
Thanks for the presentation.
I have Commissioner Koenig.
Yeah, a few questions. Thank you, Chair. On page 4-1 of the report, I'm curious why it's assumed that train sets are not required to be FRA compliant and that positive train control is not needed. My understanding are these are some new federal safety standards that basically ensure a train will brake if something happens to the operator, or if something is on the tracks and the train needs to stop suddenly. My understanding was that they were required on all passenger rail moving forward. I'm just curious why this plan says that we wouldn't need to implement that safety measure.
So right now there's two options that we evaluated. It's an FRA compliant vehicle and a non-FRA compliant vehicle. Obviously the FRA compliant would require the positive train control. But my understanding is there's other types of communications and control that's needed when you don't have the FRA compliant vehicle. But let me pass that over to Steve Decker. He also has other staff to support him if he needs it.
Right. I think it depends on the vehicle type. So usually FRA compliant vehicles are commuter rail trains. Light rail trains fall under Federal Transit Administration. And there are equivalent positive train control or equivalents to that in terms of safety for light rail trains. Maybe Shannon and or Buzz from HDR can add to that.
Yeah, Steve. There are two essentially different worlds. One is, as Steve related, is the commuter rail world, which is governed by the FRA or regulated by the FRA. And then the light rail transit world, and that would involve a firm temporal separation between intermixing of types of equipment, say freight trains running on the branch and the transit vehicles running on the branch. And if you can achieve that time separation in a very positive way, then the FRA regulations, which include PTC, would not apply, and that the operations on the branch would be handled under FTA and CPUC guidelines with a transit vehicle that is would not have to be FRA compliant.
Got it. So if we're not running freight, then we don't need the positive train control.
Thank you. In a nutshell, yeah.
Thank you for the clarification. I wanted to return to the ridership question a little bit. I understand that ridership is uncertain. I will add that with Metro, we're still seeing ridership down 85%. Regardless of trying to figure out what ridership will or will not be, has a break-even point for ridership been determined? You know, the point at which, assuming some kind of local sales tax, we would have enough, in addition to that, we would have enough fare revenue, fare box recovery to actually pay for the operation of the train.
We have not completed any kind of break even. That would have to be, we'd have to have an understanding of what the, any kind of local source of funds would be contributing in order to come up with that.
Okay, yeah, I mean, in a risk analysis, I would assume we would want, you know, some sense of how many people are going to have to use it to break even, and then, you know, ultimately what the likelihood of achieving that number is. So that was something, is something that I would really have expected to be included in this plan. Can you clarify the need and estimated cost for the replacement of the Capitola trestle to provide passenger rail?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Sure, yeah, the plan makes reference to the 24 trestles and bridges across the rail line. And of course, the Capitola trestle is possibly the most iconic. Can you clarify the need ultimately to replace the existing historic trestle and some of the costs that would be involved in that?
I think that's the question for HDR team. I don't know, Steve, if you want to leave that or if I'll pass it off to Buzz.
Yeah, you know, Buzz knows this corridor incredibly well. we did go through a cost estimation process where we had very new information about the structures, and we used that to identify need here. Obviously, there's going to be some more engineering associated with the actual infrastructure of the rail line in preliminary engineering. But Buzz, you could probably speak to this. I know we did cost out a series of new potential trestles in our cost estimates, or new structures in our cost estimates. Is this something, well, Buzz, is this something you have specifics on?
I am looking for that exact number now. I can answer the first part of your question, which is that the in almost any scenario, the Capitola trestle would be replaced or upgraded because of its current condition with the timber approaches and the wrought iron main span. The cost of that would be several million dollars, and I'm looking through a spreadsheet now trying to find that exact number. And I'm afraid that's something that we would have to get back to you on with an exact number there.
I have this spreadsheet open. The Capitola trestle is actually three, has five bridges in total. There's two concrete bridges, there's a wrought iron section that goes over Soquel Creek, and then there's a large timber trestle section and a shorter timber trestle section. So the two concrete sections are fine. The wrought iron section in the middle, the cost estimate was $4.5 million for capital only. The longer trestle section was $3.65 million for capital only. And then the shorter trestle on the west side of the wrought iron bridge was about $880,000. Now that's capital only. That's before the 50% contingency was as applied, and it's before support cost is added in. So you're looking at, you know, at least $20 million for that structure, and that's just the structure for rail. It's not for rail and trail.
All right. Oh, great. Thank you for that clarification. I know a lot of my colleagues probably have questions as well, so I'll just finish with one last one, which could you clarify, is there any reason we have to pass a resolution today, what the proposed resolution accomplishes?
We do have a requirement to meet the Rail Network Integration Study grant to have an approved or an accepted parts of this business plan, which includes the governance section, as well as the implementation steps. The requirement, we need to meet that by June 30th of this year to be able to hand over that deliverable.
All right, thank you, that's all my questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Sandy Brown, you had your hand up.
My questions were answered, thanks.
Thank you. Is there any other commissioners that'd like to ask questions of staff? None. I have a question for clarification. On this environmental, there was a lot of good questions from the commissioners. My question is the environmental documentation of the EIR, since there is a multiple transportation corridor, I guess I'd like to say, you know, going from electric rail to trail only, would the EIR cover all of those requirements? And also, if the trestles they were spoken about, if a trail only was built, these trestles would they still have to be refurbished and reconstructed so they could either be obviously for rail use, but also obviously just for a trail use? Because if anything is rail banked, there is a requirement to maintain the rail line accessible to freight services in the future. And so will these bridges would still be required to meet the mandate required?
I can start with answering the first question. As far as the environmental review, would be looking at the rail transit portion of utilizing this rail corridor. That's what it would be focused on. You know, we've just completed the alternatives analysis, so we have been able to kind of think about what our project description is and the alternatives that would be evaluated by eliminating the bus rapid transit alternative. But as far as your other question regarding the structures, I think I'd like to pass that on to Executive Director
Hi, Preston.
So we kind of looked at this corridor as, you know, what is it going to take to upgrade it for a reliable transit service? And we really didn't want to put a transit service into place where we had several bridges that were near the end of their life and would have a high probability of needing to be replaced after we start service. If we were to do that, we take the risk of having to put the new transit service out of service for a while and possibly detours, higher costs to construct if we replace it later, because we'd have to, you know, continue to operate the service, shoe fly around. So we really were kind of looking at what bridges would need to be replaced, but we were doing so only with the context of this is a transit project. The trail costs are not included in this analysis. The trail projects are moving forward separately, adjacent to the rail line. Most of the timber trestles that we have out there, pretty much all of the timber trestles you see out there, they're not able to be retrofit to cantilever a bridge off to the side. I think that's kind of where the questions are getting at. We could refurbish those trestles for trail only. I think that's what your question was. There would be some cost associated with them. I don't think we would have to continue to maintain them to the degree that they could hold a freight load at any time. We would not be allowed to remove those trestles if the line was to be rail banked. So they could be upgraded further later if we needed to reactivate the line back into service, which I think is what your question is. So you could use those trestles for trail only, but there would likely be the need for some rehabilitation costs, but it wouldn't be as high for a trail only as it would be for a rail project. And then, the trail project would assume a separate bridge adjacent to many of those timber trestles. I hope that answers your question. If not, I'm willing to talk and provide more detail.
Well, yeah, you did in a fashion. Because I mean, it's important to understand that these trestles will still have to be invested in these trestles, and it doesn't make sense to invest money that if we're in the future we're going to want to run a rail that they're not up to par, and have to reinvest in them. Is there any other further questions from the commission? CNN, I'm going to go ahead and move it out to the public for public comment. And first of all, before I open it up to public,